As you well know, appearances can be deceiving, which brings me back to the reason why we're here. We're not here because we're free. We're here because we're not free.
Up here I have different artifacts explaining. Some of them are alien metals that have been produced both on this planet and the confines of outer space that are now used in all stealth aircraft.
It's hard to tell people that our advancement in technology is so far ahead of what they know about that what they think is magic is actually real. And what they can do is project a flying object like a Boeing 767 and project light, sound, and everything it needs for people to believe that that was a Boeing 767 going at 300 miles an hour across the tops of the buildings and hitting the World Trade Center.
You are listening to an episode of Jerry Pippin's Conspiracy Hour. And now, your host, Jerry Pippin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our first show on conspiracies. Those who make conspiracies like to make fun of the idea of a conspiracy. But conspiracies happen all the time, from affairs at the office, from water cooler talk, to major government operations that result in fatalities and damage, sometimes in the billions of dollars. This show will deal with both major and minor conspiracies, some out of history, some going on right now as we speak. These programs are near and dear to my heart because I believe you, the audience, should know the truth. We should examine every idea, every concept, every alternative to what we are told by the mainstream press, government officials, and corporate spokesmen. One thing I want you to know is that we will be doing 9/11 shows. Every show will have something about 9/11. We urge you, if you are a person who knows something about 9/11, maybe you were part of the inside job, please contact me at jerry@jerrypippin.com. by email. We'll do everything possible to protect your identity, but people need to know the truth. It's been well over a decade now. We know a lot, but we know a little. By that I mean simply that a lot has been written, a lot has been videotaped, a lot has been broadcast, but at the same time, those who know have been able to just shuffle it aside and let time take care of it. One thing we do know, time does take care of conspiracies. Unfortunately, not like what we were told when we were growing up in the movies, that the wrongdoers always get caught. I've been doing this now for 5 decades, and I've noticed that seldom do the wrongdoers get caught. We have Jim Mars on a cell phone on a freeway somewhere in Texas. He's talking to us about 9/11 and other conspiracies. Listen.
I posted on my website the very next day on September the 12th. I said, this is terrible. And I said, and I agree with President Bush that we must not rest until we find out who's responsible for this and see that they're punished. I said, but let's back off and take a calm, cool, collected view of this. I said, let's don't be snookered like we have in the past. So because of that, I said, we just have to be very careful and we have to look closely at what happened on 9/11 and find out who was truly responsible. And you know, Jerry, to this very day, at least officially, that has not been done. What has been done is there is a conspiracy theory that has been adopted as the official version of 9/11. And, of course, that conspiracy theory is that 19 crazed Muslim hijackers overtook 4 commercial airliners, turned off their transponders all at the same time. flight training, unerringly guided them to their targets, the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and one was overcome by the crew and the passengers and crashed in western Pennsylvania, and all traces of them were destroyed, and all of this Mission Impossible operation was under the guidance and control of a Muslim cleric using a laptop computer in a cave in Afghanistan. Now, if that's not the most outrageous conspiracy theory I've ever heard, and the point is, it is just a theory. At least half of the people that are still identified as the 9/11 hijackers have been found to be alive in the Middle East and had nothing to do with 9/11. Half of them, okay? So we don't even know about the other half. So who were these people? And were they truly Muslim fanatics? The evidence doesn't sound like it. The Boston Globe reported that Mohammed Atta and his little team the night before, when you think they'd be praying to Allah and preparing their souls to go to heaven, they were out carousing, drinking, smoking, and looking for hookers. Sounds more like mercenaries before an operation than it does devout Muslims.
Jim Mars, along with several other investigative reporters, will be regulars on our Conspiracy Hour. So we invite you to stay tuned, as we'll have more on 9/11 before this show is over, and each week from now on. But there are other things that happen, conspiracy-wise, and one of them I was reminded of this month. 50 years, if you can believe it, since Marilyn Monroe passed away. Her official death was ruled a suicide. Many people have questioned that over the years. Did someone murder Marilyn Monroe? And if so, why? Let's turn back the clock to August 1962. In 1962, theaters played something called a newsreel, where they rehashed the week's news. Marilyn Monroe, movie idol, was appropriately featured.
One of the most famous stars in Hollywood history is dead at 36. Marilyn Monroe was found dead in bed under circumstances that were in tragic contrast to her glamorous career as a comic talent. On the surface, she seemed to have such a zest for life. Her international appeal took her from command appearances to the other side of the world and entertainment for Korean GIs. The star led a far from normal childhood and had 12 sets of foster parents, leading her to say in her last interview that she was never used to being happy, so it wasn't something she ever took for granted. She never let her personal feelings interfere with her job, and she was the idol of the GIs, the animation of Foxhole Dreams. She found no happiness in marriage. Her second husband was baseball immortal Joe DiMaggio, and that marriage ended as had her first in divorce. Her third husband was playwright Arthur Miller, and they too separated. Miss Monroe played in 23 films since her debut in 1950, films that grossed $200 million. The Golden Girl received 5,000 fan letters a week, and to those fans, she never let any personal problems dim her screen glamour. Despite flashes of temperament and tantrums, she turned in performances that kept her among the greatest box office favorites in motion picture history.
Coming up next on the Conspiracy Hour, Professor Don Burlinson will tell us why he thinks Marilyn Monroe was murdered and who he thinks did it. He thinks she was killed by some of the most respected men in American history. He will tell us why. All of that coming up next on the Conspiracy Hour. Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of jerrypippin.com. Are you curious about extraterrestrials, UFOs, alien abduction, implants, the secret space program, Area 51, and other UFO topics? Then don't miss UFOCon 2012, September 15th and 16th in Santa Clara, California. Hear 13 exciting speakers, including Douglas Dietrich, presenting Roswell as you've never heard it before. Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, will review his new discoveries about implants. Laura Eisenhower on her almost mission to Mars. Joining these speakers are Richard Dole, Chris O'Brien, Alfred Weber, Jordan Maxwell, Michael Surratt, plus five others, including special guests Sean David Morton, Russell Targ, and John B. Wells, the Saturday night host of Coast to Coast. For more information, visit the website UFOCon2012.com. That's UFOCon2012.com.
Scepter Radio Network. Internet radio uncensored, unconstrained, and unleashed. Where sometimes the questions are more dangerous than the answers. And now, your host, Jerry Pippin.
Welcome back to the Conspiracy Hour. And we're going to deal with the death of Marilyn Monroe. It's hard to believe that happened 50 years ago this month. And it was ruled a suicide. However, several people have written investigative books and articles about it, alleging that it was not suicide, but a murder. And one of those people is Professor Don Burleson, who lives in Roswell, New Mexico. And he was talking to me about his book about the murder of Marilyn Monroe and the conspiracy and who he thinks did it. So let's go ahead and play this tape that we recorded in Roswell with Don Burleson. I think you'll find it very, very interesting, intriguing, and disturbing.
Well, basically, I presented the hypothesis that Marilyn Monroe was murdered to keep her quiet about UFO-related secrets.
And we have an interview with Don on our website about this in great detail.
Well, I had this year, actually, I had an enlarged slideshow. You know, I did add some stuff to the slideshow. I had some photos and things I didn't have before.
And give us a little thumbnail speech.
Basically, the hypothesis is, and again, you know, I have to explain kind of where I'm coming from. I'm
sure
one of the hard science guys in this field. You know, I think in terms of the scientific method, in terms of hypotheses and validating them and so on. You know, basically, I believe, you know, what there's evidence for. I see no particular reason to believe what there's not evidence for. And
are you still involved in higher education?
I'm actually in the process of retiring from the mathematics department at Eastern New Mexico University, but I'll still be doing some teaching.
That was a polite way to ask if you were still teaching.
I'm still teaching mathematics, I love it. But I do come at this from the standpoint of a scientist, and basically what you do is you form an hypothesis, and you try to see to it that hypothesis is formed in such a way that it better accounts for things that are observed than other hypotheses do. My hypothesis is that, as I said, she was basically whacked, you know, by the Kennedys for the
purpose
of keeping her quiet.
And we discussed the evidence you laid out about the men.
There's the CIA memo, you know, there's the Shulgin imprint that I found on the CIA memo that links that memo with General Shulgin, who was basically the chief UFO investigator for the Air Force. In effect, he was chief of Air Intelligence Requirements Division for the old Army Air Corps, and likewise for the Air Force when it became a separate branch of the service. And the evidence really, I think, is pretty strong. That hypothesis, I believe, accounts for everything that we know about Marilyn's death, and we do know a great deal now, better than other hypotheses would. For example, you know, people have alternatively suggested that, for instance, the mafia killed her. But, in fact, Milo Spiriglio wrote a book years ago about that. But actually, that's kind of silly because the mafia really didn't want her dead. They had her house so heavily wiretapped and suited up with audio surveillance and whatnot.
And this was because Bobby Kennedy was a regular visitor.
They were digging up dirt on Bobby. And, of course, as soon as Marilyn died, all of that wire got ripped out of the house and everything, and their flow, their source of information, at least on that
from there,
on that site, you know, was gone. They still had wiretaps, you know, Peter Lawford's beach house in Santa Monica and that kind of thing. But a lot of information kind of dried up for them when Marilyn died. They didn't want her dead, you know. But my hypothesis, I think, accounts for things very clearly. Why do the audio surveillance tapes, according to the people who heard them before they were impounded, for example, show Bobby Kennedy so deranged, screaming,
he was
raving.
Like a madman.
He was like a madman. You could barely recognize his voice. I mean, come on. You know, basically, you have to wonder what justifies reactions that extreme and what doesn't. You know, and there's how you look at your hypotheses. You basically look and see how strongly does an hypothesis account for what we see and what we hear and what we know.
Could you make out what he was screaming?
Basically, the people who heard the tape said that he was saying something like, actually, I can't say everything that he said on the air, but he basically said, you know, where is it? Where the blank is it? You know, I'll pay you for it. We have to have it. My family will pay you for it. Where is it? He was looking for the diary. Jeannie Carman was over at Marilyn's house one day when Bobby was there, and Bobby grabbed the diary up and flung it across the room and said, "Get rid of this," you know. And he was really paranoid.
He was talking about getting rid of the diary because of their relationship, right?
Well, he was talking about it because he and other government officials were worried about what she might have written down in it. The CIA memo makes it very clear that they were quite worried about what she might have written down. You know, they call it the little diary of secrets, you know, and they knew that she had written things, for example,
Your premise, if I remember, is she was going to blow the UFO story.
Oh, yeah. She had actually said she had told any number of her friends, and she had actually been heard, of course, in the wiretaps and in the audio surveillance, saying she was going to hold a news conference that Monday morning and tell all. And, of course, the phrase tell all, I think, was something that could have made them extremely nervous, considering what that all might have included.
Well, right.
And, see, we don't really know whether Marilyn had actually written about her knowledge of, you know, a UFO crash retrieval in the diary night. It doesn't matter, actually, whether she actually wrote that in there or not. The point is, the CIA obviously was concerned that she might have.
And the diary, of course, has been destroyed or missing.
Well, it's missing. I put in a Freedom of Information Act request to the CIA some years ago for it. They denied that they had it. The other request I put in was for the wiretap transcripts on her telephones. And basically, of course, they turned that down. And when they did, I filed an appeal with the CIA document appended as justification for the appeal because it says she was under surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
And they accepted the appeal and sent the whole thing to the agency release panel, which, of course, had the delightful effect of authenticating the document. I'm sure they didn't intend to do me any favors, but they did me one big time.
Did you ever get to see any of that at all?
What do you mean?
The information you were asking.
Well, no, they never did actually release anything. No. And, of course, I knew they wouldn't. I mean, basically, they couldn't give me the wiretap transcripts because what is on those transcripts has to be spectacular. We know that Jose Bolaños called her just 30 minutes before she died. And later, 21 years later, when interviewed by Anthony Summers, actually said, Marilyn told me something shocking, something that will one day shock the whole world. This was in 1983, he said.
And so that wouldn't be just I'm having an affair with the president and
no,
the president's
I mean,
brother.
That was well known. The wives even knew it. I mean, it was people have said, well, maybe they didn't want their wives to know. The wives knew. I mean, come on, Ethel actually called Marilyn one time when Jeannie Carman was over and screamed at her, you know, you little tramp, stay away from my husband, stay away from Bobby. All this, and of course, Jackie knew. Jackie didn't even go to the birthday party on May 19th, 1962, where Marilyn sang to the president, because she was so ticked off that Marilyn was going to do that she left town. She went riding with her friends in Virginia, horseback riding.
So this spectacular event could very well have been the UFO thing.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. If you use logic, that's probably what it was.
Yeah. Basically, again, the hypothesis would be that it was that. There are other hypotheses, but, you know, what one ultimately has to ask oneself is how well does the Maryland UFO hypothesis account for things compared to other hypotheses? And my claim is that, yeah, as you say, in terms of the logic, it counts for them better.
You think Maryland, and I'm sure you followed this avenue up about UFOs. If I had somebody in a top government position, like Attorney General or President, that told me something about UFOs and ETs or whatever, I couldn't help but tell all the people.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing that would be very hard to...
That's the problem I have with these stories about Serpo and things like that. I don't care who they are. If you went to another planet and came back, and I don't care how sworn to secrecy you were, you're going to tell somebody.
Yeah.
You went there.
It must have been a really hard thing to stay quiet about. And, you know, the thing that must have been really terrifying for the Kennedy brothers was that they probably, you know, Jack was a blabbermouth. I mean, Marilyn wasn't the first, wasn't the last. You know, he was dating Inga Arvad, you know, when he was in naval intelligence. She was probably a Nazi spy. I mean, she sat in the same box with Hitler at the Munich Games, what can I tell you? And Jack was handling classified information in the morning and dating her in the evening. I mean, that's real judgment, isn't it? Later on, he was with other women. After his affair with Marilyn, but while Marilyn was still alive, he had an affair with Mary Pinchot Meyer, and the CIA shot her. Basically, again, out of the same kind of paranoid concern that Jack had told her things that they didn't think anybody should know.
Well, you mentioned it. Both of the Kennedys were shot. Who shot them?
Well, that's, of course, always going to be a tough one. People are always asking me, you know, do you think there was a connection between the Maryland problem and the assassination? I'm inclined not to think there's a direct connection. You know, everything's connected to everything else if you follow enough cracks in the China, you know, but... I don't think there's a direct connection.
Okay. Sir, you haven't given up on this hypothesis at all. You put this book out, right?
Yeah, UFOs and the Murder of Marilyn Monroe.
And it's still available?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, yes. My website is, my publisher's website is blackmesapress.com. And the book is there. There's a PayPal button. We make it all very easy. We think that this is the most controversial book about Marilyn ever written, but we think it's we can support, you know, all these
you got
claims.
Another book you're going to write another book?
I'll be doing it, especially now that I'm going to be retiring. I've got a little bit more time, you know, looming on my hands. I'm going to probably be doing some more books.
I mean, it goes a long ways from a mathematics professor to a book author.
Well,
and not that mathematics professors don't write books, of course they
do. I think it all kind of stems from the same impulses. You know, besides teaching, I do research in mathematics and matrix theory. I just discovered a new theorem in December in the theory of matrices. And I've put that actually on a page on my website, hoping that somebody will look at it and see if they can find out how it applies to quantum theory, because I think it does. I'm not a physicist, and so I don't exactly know how it would apply, but I think it must. And I think all of these impulses kind of stem from the same sort of attitude. You know, if you want to produce things, you want to try to be creative. You know, the irony is I'm 65. I was 64 going on 65 when I discovered the theorem. They always say that one's mathematical creativity is supposed to dry up at about the age of 40. Or so, but actually, that's a load of crap, if you ask me.
So you haven't felt that, at least as far as you're concerned.
Oh, certainly not. I mean, actually, John von Neumann, you know, said that mathematicians were through being creative at the age of 25. And I don't know what the hell he was talking about. He wasn't through at the age of 25. So, I mean, come on, what is he saying?
Well, you're a mathematics guy. You're into this stuff. You're not. We mentioned quantum physics. How do you explain all of these UFOs? I guess there's something involved there. They go from zero to God knows how fast.
Yeah, well,
I mean, there's been more than one sighting of that.
Of course, and I think really, you know,
how does that happen?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's ironic. Carl Sagan, and I really liked Carl. You know, I was devastated when he died so young. You know, but Carl used to say that he didn't think that we were visited by aliens,
right,
because of the vast distances involved and so forth. Carl perfectly well knew better than that. You know, he knew that basically that was assuming that, you know, we know everything about physics, but they do. And, of course, that's an assumption that cannot actually be maintained or supported. But, of course, Carl didn't really think these things. You know, in private, Carl actually thought that some UFOs were real and we had been visited.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was actually...
I thought he was a complete skeptic.
No. He said he was, but it was because he was protective of his public funding and everything. Carl was actually sitting backstage with Alan Hynek one time, waiting to go on for a discussion. Alan Hynek was the founder of the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. And they were sitting there together, and it was going to be kind of a friendly debate, you know, on some TV show. And just before they were called to go on, Carl turned to Alan and said, "You know, Alan, I know as well as you do that some UFOs are real. But if you think I'm going to walk out there in front of a television camera, in front of an audience, and say something like that and endanger my funding, my grant money, and so forth, I'm sorry, you're wrong. I'm just not going to do it. I can't do it."
Well, that kind of, in a nutshell, describes part of the problem with the UFO field, doesn't it?
Of course. I'm an academic, and, of course, I was lucky enough to be working in a place where it wasn't a stigma of any kind. I mean, after all, Eastern New Mexico University, and we're in Roswell, right?
You can
talk
so
about UFOs, and nobody gets too unstrung.
You know, I was talking to somebody last night about that. This is a good place, even with the atmosphere and everything, at least you can discuss the subject with a straight face.
Yeah.
And people listen to you.
Well, and if you're an academic here, you can actually be interested.
That's what's fine, but on a higher level, people are still accepting.
And they're not going to get, you know, here they're not going to get all down on you and everything for doing that.
Right.
But, you know, really, in many universities, if you were... vocally interested in UFOs, and you were going up for tenure, you'd probably be you'd have a problem.
Oh yeah, we've discussed that with several people.
Yeah, I mean it's still considered déclassé. You know what really ticks me off?
What?
The fact that you walk into a bookstore and you look for the UFO books, and you know where you find them shelved? You find them with books on tarot card reading and astrology and fortune telling and witchcraft and so forth. But come on, give me a break. Those things are basically worthless forms of superstition.
Mm-hmm.
The UFO phenomenon is science. At least at its best it should be.
Yeah, and that's a good way to end the interview. Tell me the name of the book again.
UFOs and the Murder of Marilyn Monroe.
A few words about the Marilyn Monroe suicide. And it was ruled a suicide by the coroner's office in Los Angeles. No one really has been able to come up with a smoking gun to say it was a murder. All evidence seems to point that maybe it was not suicide simply because of Marilyn's attitude. She had had some pretty severe emotional problems with Joe DiMaggio first and then later Arthur Miller. And then the president's brothers rumored to have an affair with her. But most people who knew her were shocked that she chose this time to commit suicide, as she seemed to have a better attitude and seemed to be actually recovering from her depression. It's one of those things we'll never know. But the conspiracy theorist, and rightly so in my opinion, believe perhaps there was a reason for Marilyn to be murdered. You heard Don refer to the famous birthday song by Marilyn Monroe at John Kennedy, President Kennedy's birthday. Listen carefully, and listen to what Peter Lawford says.
This lovely lady is not only constitutional, but punctual. Mr. President, Marilyn Monroe. Because in the history of show business, perhaps there has been no one female who meant so much, who has done more.
president for all the things you stand, the battles that you run, the way you deal with U.S. Steel, and our problems by the ton will settle so much.
Now retire from politics after having had a happy birthday sung to me in such a sweet
moment. And that is just one of many, many conspiracy theories connected with the Kennedy family. Not only back in the 60s, but even later with son John. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at 9/11 again. I'm Jerry Pippin. And this is the Conspiracy Hour. Later on, we'll even deal with Louisiana sinkholes. Don't go away.
You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love, a gift of life, to that stray dog or cat. This is a Jerry Pippin 9/11 special. Was a perfect storm of interests coming together, and most of the players were unaware of the actions of the others. Who was the mastermind? Probably Dick Cheney, but this is far from proven at this time. And the why was also a perfect storm. We will begin to show you how it all came together and how loyal Americans doing their jobs were the secret of its success. We feature an overview and some witness testimony by an unwitting witness who years later came to the attention of fellow investigative reporters and associates Kerry Cassidy and Bill Ryan of Project Camelot. The story is astounding and shakes one to the very foundation of our outrage. In these programs, we plan to reveal our hypothesis on 9/11. This is a series that is in for a long haul, an uphill battle to uncover those who, in fact, are accessories to mass murder. The main thrust of this story is simply that the core group of devils who created this plan is incredibly small, but they're reaching out by using a system, the system itself, the military, and Black Ops, the code of conduct, need to know. And in fact, you had patriotic people doing their jobs thinking they were defending America, while in actual fact they were aiding and abetting and actually doing the dirty deed itself. We are going to present it the way we think it happened. And then we will start filling in the blanks. A very brave young woman has come forward with a key to the castle of black secrecy. And we add the credit going to fellow journalists, investigative reporters Kerry Cassidy and Bill Ryan of Project Camelot. We have their complete interview posted here, and it's also on the Project Camelot website. We urge you to take time to listen to it. Here's an excerpt when the PFC tells Bill what she heard that morning, September 11th, 2001.
I didn't hear a thing about hijackers. Mm-hmm. I just heard that this plane was flying in a no-fly zone, and they couldn't make contact with the plane or something like this. There was no communication. Protocol says it has to be taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in this room when the decision was mutually made by the people talking on the phone in the room that I was in to shoot this plane down.
The voice of the woman is a lady who was in medical training at Fort Meade, Maryland. And she is talking about what happened to her by happenstance. She was pulled into service to get the brass refreshments as they had to reach a decision, and a decision fast, because Flight 93 was not answering the radio calls, and it was in the most dangerous airspace of them all. It was over a secret underground command center and near Camp David. And it looked like it was on its way back to Washington, D.C. You must remember it had been only minutes, not hours, since the Twin Towers had exploded before these people's eyes on television. And military protocol called for a shoot down of any aircraft over this airspace. Listen closely as Bill Ryan, the reporter, asked the PFC to read something he found off the internet.
You're welcome to read that to the microphone.
The Raven Rock Mountain Complex, RRMC, is a United States government facility on Raven Rock, a mountain in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania. It's located about 14 kilometers east of Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, and 10 kilometers northeast of Camp David, Maryland. I've never seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
It is also called the Raven Rock Military Complex, or simply Site R. Other designations and nicknames include the Rock National Military Command Center Reservation and Alternate National Military Command Center, Alternate Joint Communication Sentence, Backup Pentagon.
That's exactly what you said, isn't it?
Yeah. This is the housing place of the representatives and the mm-hmm. congressmen and all of the... It's not for mm-hmm. people, it's for the government to go
mm-hmm.
hide.
Mm-hmm.
Backup Pentagon, or Site RT, the latter refers to the vast array of communication towers and equipment atop the mountain. It's known as an underground Pentagon. This is fascinating.
Now to our working theory on why Flight 93 was shot down. It is our feeling, and we expect to prove this in later programs, something very, very far out, but we believe it is the truth. And that is, all the passengers from all the airplanes were diverted to someplace in Pennsylvania. We have a theory about where it was, and we'll get to that later, and why we think it was at a certain place. All of the passengers were loaded onto Flight 93, explained to them that they were on their way to Los Angeles at this 9/11 event was taking place, and then the plane was flown by remote control over an airspace that the planners knew that the military would shoot down the plane. Therefore, getting rid of all of the evidence of the passenger list. And the official story about Flight 93 and the passengers taking over the plane and it crashing into the ground, how did our PFC feel about that story? Listen carefully.
I remember the distinct feeling inside of me of when I saw in the news that there was this story that there were terrorists on this plane and that the people overtook the pilot and crashed the plane so that... overtook the terrorists and crashed the planes themselves. And how this was leaking out as these people being heroes. And I remember the extreme moral frustration inside of me of being like, but that's not true. That's not true at all. We shot this down. And a huge conflict inside of me of knowing that the world is made, or to believe this story that's not true, and how people just buy this. And I felt that that was really wrong. You know, why couldn't they just say, strict military protocol. It's a no-fly zone. Sorry.
Now, maybe you begin to get the picture of why the officials couldn't just say they were in a no-fly zone. We didn't know. We shot them down. We were doing our duty. It's because they wanted to keep the terrorists front and center. And the best way is for no evidence of any passengers anywhere. Jim Fitzer, who has been helping us all along with scholarsfor911truth.org, has a theory about the television pictures. Supposedly, there was no telecast live of the plane hitting the first tower. But is that true? Listen to what our PFC says. She tells Bill Ryan, one of the top officers came running into the room, saying he just saw an airplane hit Tower 1.
Which has never been acknowledged in the public domain.
Yes.
So he saw the first plane crash, and then he came in to tell that to you.
Mm-hmm. The department, it was just a big hallway, and he just saw this, and then he walked back, and there was maybe six or seven of us standing there, and he said, "Holy shit. There's a plane just crashed into the tower."
Yeah.
And a few of us were like, "What? Really?" And we went to see for ourselves. And we were standing there watching this building on fire.
One building on fire.
Yes. And as we stood there, we saw the second plane come.
Yeah.
And then all of us, I think there was like four of us standing there at the moment. Me, him, two other people. It's hard to remember. Yes. And we stood there and said, "Holy shit, that wasn't an accident. Something's happening."
And do you remember, was there any commentary, like any newscaster saying, "Oh my God," or it was just a picture?
It's just the picture. And I don't, there wasn't any news, there wasn't anybody running. I mean, as far as I remember, and we didn't stay long at the TV, because it happened almost immediately that over the loudspeaker, following this, I would say within, 10 minutes, something came over the loudspeaker, maybe even less than 10 minutes, for soldiers to report and get their weapons.
Get their weapons?
Yes.
Because?
To protect the base.
As a standard procedure an apparent act of war?
Yes. But not me. Not me, because I was in training.
Okay. So, and of course, George Bush himself, in an apparent slip of the tongue to the press, said that he had seen it and had said something like that he'd thought to himself, "My God, that's some terrible pilot."
Mm-hmm.
And then he said that when he saw the second plane crash, he realized that there was an attack. That's what he said. So he could have seen whatever it was that you're talking about here. So it seems to be a real event. Okay. Talk us through what happened then with you and your movements that day.
So after this, I believe it was the first sergeant of the hospital and the commander. First sergeant is in the sergeant rankings and a commander is in the officer rankings. And the first sergeant of our department gathers all together, told us that the soldiers that were stationed there, they needed to report to the command center, basically. And so all the other departments of soldiers, the nursing department, the clerical, administrative department, everybody sent their base soldiers there, and I didn't see them anymore. So basically the hospital was not fully active at that point. Everything was on hold.
Mm-hmm.
And those soldiers, my friends later told me that they were on 24-hour duty shifts of manning the gates and patrolling the surrounding of the area of the base.
Mm-hmm.
For me and the one other student that was there, our first sergeant, she was a really nice woman. She was very sweet. She offered us up to the commander of the hospital and I believe the commander of the base to be of service to them. Because we didn't have the right to bear arms while we're in training or something like this, some logistical thing. And so she gave us to them.
Because it was something useful you could do.
that we could be useful, because nobody was in the department anymore, so we needed to, okay, get rid of these two soldiers, you can take them.
Okay.
And so I remember the room that they took us into, and they told us that we were in charge of, you know, getting coffees, any kind of snacks from the cafeteria, or not cafeteria, like from the snack machines or from the place where you can get little snacks, in charge of making photocopies, because she and I had the access codes for the rooms to get in there.
Because these guys were having a meeting.
Exactly.
It was a major meeting precipitated by the fact that this event had just happened.
Yes.
And that's all you knew.
That's all that I knew, and it was made very clear to us that we were not to look at them.
Mm-hmm.
They sat us in chairs at the far end of the room, not facing them. And we were told to look at the wall and not listen to anything we heard. This was our direct orders. And so she and I sat there, staring at the wall, sometimes, you know, nudging each other or you know, just talking a little bit or something, but really being very soldierly about this. And there was probably 6 or 7 men around this very large table, just like you would see in a big office somewhere. And they had this funny phone. It was like a conference call phone. And I remember them sitting there and they were talking through this phone. And it seemed to me that they were talking to one or two other places.
Did you know the names and ranks of the people in the room?
I do not know the names and ranks of the people in the room. I do know that it was, at the time, the head commander of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the commander of the base.
Right, these are two different men.
Yeah, there's the guy who oversees the hospital, and then there's the guy who oversees the base.
Okay.
And right. I don't know their ranks, but they were, in my opinion, they were the top ranked in the room.
Okay.
And then there were other officers and other, maybe a few first sergeants in the room as well.
Mm-hmm. And the conversation around the table was like, okay, guys, what's going on here?
Okay, guys, what's going on here? I felt stress and some unknowingness and some fear,
mm-hmm.
but they hold it so well,
mm-hmm.
really. They hold themselves together. And then the topic turned to a plane that was flying in a no-fly zone near to Camp David and heading towards Site R. I had no idea what Site R was, and to me, Camp David was a place where George Bush went on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know any more than that.
And this was information that was coming in on this telephone from elsewhere.
Yes, and they were discussing this of protocol is that this is a no-fly zone. We have to take this plane down. Yes, it's a passenger plane. It needs to be taken down. It's a no-fly zone.
As you can see, she verifies the name of that underground secret base operated by Black Ops in Pennsylvania. Flight 93 turned out to be the key to the entire operation. So that was why the lies were made. And that's why the fake phone calls were made to the family. And that's how we got the media involved with Let's Roll. The masterminds of 9/11 knew the media very well. They knew how to play the media. They knew how to redirect the media away from any questions. And there were lots of questions. This has been the prelude to Program 3. On the next hour, which is Program 3, we will discuss thermite, the necessary ingredient for the planned explosion of the Twin Towers. We'll get into that video. Could there have been one that was not shown to the public? Who would have shot it? Did the CIA or someone, the armed forces, did they have a secret television crew there? Or was it a commercially available crew that was paid off later with prime time money for a special on 9/11? And then there's the Pentagon. We have witnesses who say they were ordered not to go to work that day. And others who told one story and later
Major, told nice another. To see you again. We asked you here today in an effort to clear up some things regarding your testimony on September 28th, 2001. This won't take long.
Major Cruder, Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do swear that.
Major, you stated at the hearing in September that General Ackerley referred to that you saw American Airlines Flight 77 hit the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. Is that correct, Major? I'll repeat the question if you'd like, Major.
I was confused.
So, what does that mean, Major? You were confused, but yes, you saw Flight 77, or no, you were confused, but you did not see Flight 77?
No, I did not see Flight 77.
I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower of a TV. You know, the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said, it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there and didn't have much time to think about it.
More details on 9/11 next week. Stay tuned. We'll be back to wrap this up and talk about the Louisiana problem. Don't go away. Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual, on the paranormal pages of JerryPippin.com.
Scepter Radio Network. Internet radio uncensored, unconstrained, and unleashed. Where sometimes the questions are more dangerous than the answers. And now, your host, Jerry Pippin.
Just when the Gulf Coast and Louisiana thought all the problems were over with the British Petroleum oil spill, guess what? They have new problems. Listen to this report from Baton Rouge Television.
This sinkhole is swallowing up more of Bayou corn. The sinkhole grew overnight.
Infrared equipment shows it's 10 to 20 feet wider. The sinkhole expanded to the north and south. A National Guard helicopter crew noticed the changes using special equipment. Some are worried about radiation in the area now. New at 6 o'clock, News 2's Adrian Pittman has more on that and what state experts say about it.
That fear comes after Texas brine was given the green light to fill its empty brine cavern with naturally occurring radioactive material years ago. Now that scientists believe that cavern maybe have collapsed, concerns swarm about what could leak out, so experts tested air samples and the mud in the sinkhole for radiation. Preliminary tests show at no point were there any detectable levels. The Department of Environmental Quality says now this is one less problem people living on Bayou Corn have to worry about.
It's a bittersweet deal. I mean, it's one thing that we don't have to worry about, which is great news, but we still have to move forward to provide the data needed to everyone involved so they can make more decisions. It's not over. This is just one part of it.
An additional water sample and soil samples were also taken today and sent to the lab for more detailed analysis. But those results should be back sometime next week. And a short time ago, the Department of Natural Resources ordered Texas brine to give daily reports on that cavern. Adrian Pittman, WBRZ, Balanced News.
Thank you, Adrian. Crews are also checking on bubbles in Bayou Corn connected to all of this. So far, there's been no change. The bubbles appeared weeks ago at the beginning of the summer. The sinkhole developed about a week ago.
The sheriff says there's 1.5 million gallons of butane ready to explode. I'm sure we'll hear more about this story. That's our show for tonight. Thanks for listening. I'm Jerry Pippin. See you next week. Cheers.
Thank you for joining us for more original Scepter Radio programming. Where listening uncovers the world has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. For questions or comments, email us at scepterradionetwork@gmail.com or visit us on the web at www.scepterradionetwork.com. Until next time.